Today we look at an important chapter in the Warren Report, Chapter 3, The Shots from the Texas School Book Depository. The Warren Commission did a good job in this chapter of meticulously laying out the evidence for not only shots from the Texas School Book Depository, but also the possibility that there were shots fired from elsewhere. But the chapter makes clear that the evidence for shots elsewhere is quite slight. And for the most part, the chapter does a fine job of explaining why the shots almost certainly came from one place and one place only, the sixth floor on the southeast corner of the depository building. Here are the sections in this chapter. 1. The testimony of eyewitnesses present at the scene of the assassination. 2. The damage to the presidential limousine. 3. The examination by qualified experts of the rifle and cartridge cases found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, and the bullet fragments found in the presidential limousine and at Parkland Hospital. 4. The wounds suffered by President Kennedy and Governor Connally. 5. Wound ballistic tests. 6. The examination by qualified experts of the clothing worn by President Kennedy and Governor Connally. And finally, motion picture films, especially the Zapruder film, and still photographs taken at the time of the assassination. The predominant witnesses were Howard Brennan and Amos Ewens. Brennan was a 45-year-old steam fitter, and there's a picture of him posing in 1964 on the spot where he was able to get a good view of the sixth-floor window. And Amos Ewens, who was 15 years old and probably playing hooky from school, when he also was able to see the sixth-floor window and see a rifle sticking out of that window in the seconds before and during the assassination. Brennan said that he heard 2 shots, and Ewens said that he thought that there were 4 shots. But it's interesting that Brennan saw Oswald firing the final shot, and since he thought that was a second shot and he saw Oswald pulling the rifle away, there was no reason for Brennan to think that there were more than 2 shots. Somehow, Brennan missed the first shot, but so did almost everybody else, because they mistook the first shot as a misfire or a backfire on a motorcycle. So it's not surprising that Brennan heard 2 shots. Ewens, though, said that after he heard the second shot, he ran around the corner to crouch down behind a stone fence, and then said he heard 2 shots. So it's likely that Ewens heard 4 shots simply because he was racing for cover and was in terror, unlike Brennan, who saw that Oswald had completed his shooting. So that would explain the discrepancy between Ewens' 4 shots and Brennan's 2 shots, neither of which was exactly accurate. There were also reporters who heard the shots, and some of them also saw a pipe-like object being withdrawn from the window. They were not able to identify a person in the window. They only saw the rifle. So did the wife of the mayor of Dallas. She saw a pipe-like object in the window, but she was not able to identify a person. Perhaps the most important witnesses were those on the fifth floor, who were directly under the position that Oswald was in. These would be Junior Jarman, or James Jarman Jr., as his real name was, Bonnie Ray Williams, and Harold Norman. They were all workers at the depository who happened to be watching the motorcade from the fifth floor. They were clear that at the time of the assassination, they could hear 3 shots being fired directly above them. They could even feel the building shake. Cement from the upper floor was pouring down on their heads, and Harold Norman was very clear that he not only could hear the bolt being worked 3 times, but he could hear the shells hitting the floors at the same time that the shots were fired. And when Bonnie Ray Williams and Junior Jarman said that they thought that the shots were coming from directly above them, Harold Norman said, "I know they are coming from directly above us because I can hear the shells hitting the floor." There were actually cracks in the ceiling, and one could see from the fifth floor, the lights on, on the sixth floor through these cracks. One could not see, however, people moving back and forth, only a stream of light. Harold Norman and the others rushed to the west side of the floor immediately after the assassination so they could see more of Elm Street. And after a moment's pause, they decided to go downstairs to see what was happening outside. They never made a decision to go upstairs, even though that's where they thought the shots were fired from. And the Warren Commission makes clear that in the months after the assassination, they restaged this scene on the fifth floor to see if indeed shells from a rifle discharged above the fifth floor could be heard on the fifth floor. And this restaging took place more than three times in the months after 1963. And on one occasion, all seven of the commissioners were there and clearly heard shells drop to the floor above them. Now, the chapter goes on to say that there were witnesses on the Triple Underpass who thought that there were shots coming from the so-called grassy knoll or the area around the Triple Underpass, which was virtually the same thing. One person even said he saw a puff of smoke. However, the problem with this is that some of these witnesses later changed their minds and said that all they could hear were probably reverberations from the sounds that echoed from other quarters, namely the sixth floor window of the Texas School Book Depository. Dealey Plaza was an echo chamber, and it's not surprising that some people thought that they heard shots coming from the area west of the Texas School Book Depository, that is, the Triple Underpass, because that was one of the points in the Dealey Plaza echo chamber from which sounds would have reverberated. It's interesting to note that for all the shots that were thought to have come from that area around the Triple Underpass, and for all the talk about smoke, puffs of smoke, which could have come from other sources, there were no shots that hit the car that could have come from any area forward of the car, including the grassy knoll. So any shots that would have been fired from the grassy knoll, they all missed. And that is curious in and of itself, although those who support the idea of conspiracy, of course, argue, as the House Select Committee did in 1979, that a missed shot still provides evidence of conspiracy. But when you consider the reporting of numerous shots from this area, it's curious that none of them hit the car or any person within, offering some evidence that probably there were no shots at all. Further evidence that there were no shots from this area are twofold. First of all, the parking lot behind the wooden fence at the top of what was called the grassy knoll, which was not really a knoll at all, because a knoll implies that there is a slope in front and a slope behind. But there was no slope behind. There was a level parking lot behind. And that parking lot was in the full view of Lee Bowers, who worked at a railroad tower that overlooked that area. And Bowers was watching that area the whole time, and he saw no one in that area. It would have been a very poor place for a gunman to perch himself, since he could see by turning around that he was in full view of the railroad tower that loomed over it. And of course, anyone parking in that area would have seen any gunman quite clearly leaning against a fence. And when, after the assassination, policemen and people in Dealey Plaza began to run up the grassy knoll to the fence, they found no one on the other side. They found no shells. And so what we have is the fact that there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever in the form of shells, bullets, shooters, or anything that there were any shots fired from that location. There were people who reported hearing shots in that area, some of whom later concluded that they had heard reverberations. And it's also curious that Abraham Zapruder, who was only about 10 feet away from the fence, reported hearing no shots from that quarter. He could not identify the source of the shots because, again, Dealey Plaza was an echo chamber. But anyone shooting from 10 feet away would surely have blasted Zapruder's ears out, and nothing of the sort happened. Now, I'm filling in some of the gaps in this chapter. This chapter does not contain all of the observations that I've just been providing in this recording, but it does make clear that there just is no evidence other than a few witnesses who reported hearing shots from that quarter. There is no evidence that would have to be present for such reports to be corroborated, such as a person running away, shells located somewhere. These things would have been in the area if shots had indeed been fired. Now, the presidential automobile also provides compelling evidence that the shots came from behind. I've already mentioned that the presidential windshield was hit from inside, showing that a bullet had been fired from above and behind. But in addition, the wounds to the president and John Connally were such that they had to be fired from above and behind. Kennedy was hit in the upper back. A wound of exit in his throat demonstrated that. Connally was also hit in the upper back on the right side of his body, and the bullet emerged and eventually planted itself in his left thigh. Obviously, the bullet was going downward. Now, there is a discussion in this chapter of Malcolm Perry, the doctor at Parkland Hospital, who made quite a sensation when he was questioned by the press in the immediate aftermath of the attempt to save the president's life. Perry said that he thought that there could have been a wound of entrance in the president's neck that might have been a bullet entering there, hitting his spine, and then turning upward, going through his head, and causing all the wounds in the head. So according to Perry, who had no knowledge, of course, of the sequence of the shots, Perry was wondering if one shot could have caused both of Kennedy's wounds, not only the throat wound, but also the head wound. But Perry, who performed the tracheotomy on the president, did not know that the wound he was obliterating was a wound of exit, not entrance. And he was simply speculating that it could have been a wound of entrance. But of course, we know from the bullet evidence in the car and the evidence at Parkland Hospital that a bullet that hit no bone passed through President Kennedy's back, passed between the strap muscles of his upper shoulder, passed through the neck, hit Connally, grazed some bones, grazed bones in the wrist, and was found as a nearly whole bullet at Parkland Hospital. There were terribly shattered bullet fragments found in the front of the presidential limousine, which were the remnants of the bullet that hit President Kennedy's head in the form of the third shot. And these bullets were where you would expect them to be, in the front seat of the presidential automobile. They were also in mangled condition, as you would expect them to be, after hitting the president's skull, shattering the skull, and also shattering the bullets that caused the skull to break into two, and then were left in the front seat of the car. Any shots that were fired at the car from in front of the car would not have produced fragments that remained in the front of the car, but the fragments would either have gone behind the car or be in the back seat. That's not what happened. So the ballistic evidence and the evidence from the autopsy of the wounds to the president's body and John Connally's body showed that shots were fired from above and behind. And even in the Warren Report, which was produced less than a year after the assassination, these details are clear. The next section of the chapter is very important because it focuses on the trajectory of the bullets. And there is a section that says, first bullet that hit, which is very well written because, as the Warren Commission understood, the first shot missed, or at least the Warren Commission suspected that it missed. We now know that indeed it did miss, but the Warren Commission was suitably cautious on that point. But what it did, which was so fascinating, was that it had a reenactment of the assassination by using a car which they synchronized with the Zapruder film by putting FBI agent Robert Frazier in the sixth floor window with the Mannlicher Carcano, placing a motion picture camera on the gun so that what we see in the motion picture is what Oswald saw. And they inched the car up foot by foot between the locations of frame 207 and 210 to try to see what Oswald saw and to see if the two individuals who were stand-ins for Kennedy and Connally were in the same trajectory line so that a straight point from the sixth floor window would pass through Kennedy and then pass through Connally, who was behind Kennedy from Oswald's perspective. So by inching the car forward foot by foot and then comparing the image through the viewfinder with the autopsy results that show the locations of the wounds on Kennedy and Connally, the Warren Commission could determine roughly the locations of the frames when Connally would be in a position to be straight in front of Kennedy, that is, on a straight line from the sixth floor window, and therefore the location or Zapruder film location where the shots would have taken place, even though this was when the presidential automobile was behind the sign that blocked Zapruder's view of the car. We know that when Kennedy and Connally emerge from the sign, they are already hit. And therefore, it's possible to say, roughly, that the shot must have hit when the two men were behind the sign. But where? And the closest the Warren Commission could come from its reenactment was sometime between frames 207 and 210, which is a fairly narrow period of time, and it allows us to have a fairly precise knowledge of when these shots would have occurred. But of course, what we're really saying is that we know that John Connally was lined up perfectly to receive a shot that first hit John F. Kennedy in the upper back sometime when the car was behind the sign. The exact second when it was behind the sign, when the shot occurred, is less important than that the individuals were lined up at some point in that time frame. Now, aside from what we see in Chapter 3, we can also say that the Warren Commission had it slightly wrong. In fact, the Warren Commission admitted that whether the shots lined up at 207 to 211 or at some other point would have been determined by how Connally was moving. Connally was the one who was most in motion at this time. First, he tried to turn to his right, and then he tried to turn to his left to see the president. And while he was making these motions, his body was moving quite dramatically. And so if he had lifted himself off his seat to try to turn radically to his left, then his position relative to Kennedy and Oswald would have been slightly different. And in that case, the 207 to 211 frame estimate might well have been incorrect. And the Warren Commission admits that in this chapter. Well, it appears that the actual frame wherein the shot was fired was probably frame 222 or 223. Kennedy was still behind the sign, but Connally was just emerging from the sign. And we know this because at frame 223 or 224, we can see Connally's lapel flap on his jacket flapping upward, which tells us that almost certainly one frame earlier, the shot that hit Kennedy and Connally struck. We can't see Kennedy, but we can see Connally. And a moment later, we see Kennedy emerging from the sign with his arms flying up in front of his throat. Connally does not react to the shot represented by the lapel flap for 1/2 second. But that's not surprising because Connally's reaction was mediated by pain, whereas Kennedy's reaction was the result of a spinal injury. None of these facts appear in Chapter 3. However, it is verified in Chapter 3 that there is a section of time between 2:07 and 2:10, and now we know between 2:07 and 2:23, when Kennedy and Connally were lined up in a position in which they could have received the same shot. Again, much depends on Connally's movements during that period, which we cannot see precisely. We can see Connally's position at frame 223 when the lapel flap flips up, but we cannot see Kennedy's position relative to his. And both of those would have to be known in order to make a precise determination if they were lined up properly. But Chapter 3 shows us that they were lined up properly a split second earlier, and therefore they were probably lined up correctly at 2:23 as well. Many people argue that there are discrepancies in the evidence in the JFK case, but there would be a lot more discrepancies if there was not so much evidence that there were three shots fired in the assassination. First of all, there were three shells discovered in the sixth floor window that we've looked at. But in addition, there's a lot more evidence of three shots. First of all, there is ballistic evidence that there were at least two shots. The hole bullet found at Parkland is related to the shot that hit JFK in the neck and Connally in the back. And then there are two fragments that were found in the front seat that were the remnants of the shot that hit President Kennedy in the head at frame 313 of the Zapruder film. That leaves one other shot because the vast majority of witnesses in Dealey Plaza reported hearing three shots. There were quite a few witnesses who reported hearing four shots, some even reported hearing five, and others, for example, Abraham Zapruder himself, said that he only heard two shots. But the great majority of witnesses heard three, and that fact alone would weigh heavily in the theory that there were indeed three shots. And it was, of course, backed up by the shells in the sixth floor window. Also, Dealey Plaza is an echo chamber, as we've said, and there are several sounds that are associated with shots. Even a single shot is associated with more than one and as many as three separate sounds. There's the sound of the gas explosion, the sound of the muzzle, and then the sound of the shot actually hitting something, if indeed it hits something. Those three things alone would constitute reason for discrepancy in the witness reactions. But also the fact that Dealey Plaza has so many buildings that echo with the shots also would explain different reactions from witnesses. Lawyers will always tell you that witness testimony is the most unreliable testimony, or the most unreliable form of evidence, I should say, and that although people put great weight on witness testimony, it turns out to be not as reliable as other types of evidence. So in addition, we have the Zapruder film, which tells us a great deal about the number of shots. First of all, you have the reaction of Rosemary Willis on the Zapruder film. Rosemary Willis was a child who was the daughter of a photographer, Phil Willis, who took some of the most important pictures that morning in Dealey Plaza. She was running alongside the limousine containing JFK at the time of the first shot. We can see Rosemary Willis stopping while she's running and looking back at the Texas School Book Depository as the presidential vehicle continues down Elm Street. At this point in the Zapruder film, JFK has not yet been hit, but we know that he was hit by the second bullet, not the first. So Rosemary Willis's reaction and her look back to the sixth floor window is proof positive that there was a shot that missed prior to the shot that hit JFK and John Connally. And Rosemary Willis also was interviewed in later years, and she testified that the reason she looked back and stopped running was because she heard a shot coming from behind her and from behind the president from the Texas School Book Depository building. But we don't have to rely just on Rosemary Willis. The Secret Service agents, who were, of course, trained to react to and recognize bullet shots, were looking all over the place following that first shot that Rosemary Willis reacted to. They looked at each other. They looked to the left. They looked to the right. George Hickey looked down at his left because he thought he heard a firecracker hitting on his left side. George Reedy was looking to his right and looking around the people who were in the car in front of him, George Reedy being one of the Secret Service agents in the Queen Mary automobile directly behind the president's car. Reedy can be seen looking around the passengers in front of him to see if something had happened to the president. At the Zapruder frame in which Reedy is shown looking around to his right and looking directly at the president, this is a Zapruder frame prior to frames 223 and 224, when we know that the second shot hit. And later that day, November 22nd, Reedy wrote in his manual what he remembered from that afternoon. And he said that what he remembered was hearing a shot, or something that sounded like a shot. And he remembered looking directly at the president. And he said that he saw a bullet hit the president's back about 4 inches below his neck, and that at that point he saw the president list to his left. The important point about Reedy's written testimony was that he wrote this on Air Force One while returning to Washington before any of the other evidence indicating that there was a second shot had come in. Hickey noticed that President Kennedy was hit in his upper back. Nobody else knew that at the time, and the fact that Hickey saw this happening in real time is further evidence for the single bullet theory, because it also captures the fact that it was a second shot that hit the president, since Reedy was looking at the president precisely because he was worried for him, since he had heard a previous shot that happened a few semi-seconds before Abraham Zapruder had restarted his camera. This means that by frame 133 of the Zapruder film, the very first frame in which we see the presidential car, the assassination had already begun, and it was going to last a much longer time sequence than the Warren Commission ever dreamed. The Warren Commission, along with everybody else, had assumed that Abraham Zapruder had captured the entire JFK assassination simply because they were so mesmerized by the Zapruder film. We do see that at the beginning of the Zapruder film, frame 133, JFK is happily waving to the crowd. So it was a simple assumption to make, wrong though it turned out to be, that the shots had not yet begun, because President Kennedy was not hit at that time. But what we now know is that the first shot had preceded the beginning of the Zapruder film, or the resumption of the Zapruder film, because as we know, Zapruder stopped his camera when he realized that the presidential vehicle was not going to come onto the scene and be visible to him for quite a few seconds. And when he resumed his camera, the presidential vehicle was already some distance down Elm Street, and the first shot had already occurred, although Abraham Zapruder never really heard it or couldn't remember it, because all he reported were the two shots that he had captured on his movie film. Those were the only two shots that Zapruder could remember. So the reactions of the Secret Service agents show with complete certainty that there was a shot fired. And of course, Rosemary Willis further backs this up because she was reacting to the first shot as she later testified. And so we know that there were three shots. We don't have to just believe that there were three shots, or suppose that there were three shots, or surmise that there were three shots. We know with complete certainty that there were three shots, and all the evidence backs it up, including the three shells found in the sniper's perch in the sixth floor of the southeast corner of the Texas School Book Depository. Many of these points made in this podcast are the result of discoveries made since the Warren Report was published. So I'm deviating from Chapter 3, but the remarkable point is that these discoveries do not contradict the Warren Commission's findings in Chapter 3. They simply add evidentiary support to those findings, and yet we see them in Chapter 3 all the same. The Warren Commission turned out to be right for more reasons than it knew. Chapter 3 of the Warren Report reminds us that the government, in the form of the Warren Commission, investigated the JFK assassination to such an extent that we know almost from an hour-to-hour basis every movement Lee Harvey Oswald took, and we've investigated every aspect of the case. The U.S. government, and I deliberately use the term we, because I consider the U.S. government to be the voice of the American people. This has always been the way the U.S. government was regarded until the administration of Ronald Reagan and all of the others who followed and raised questions about the legitimacy and honesty of the U.S. government. Reagan was the first president to say such a thing, such a disgraceful thing, as the government is not the answer to our problems. The government is the problem, as if there is one source for all the problems that exist in the United States. Prior to Ronald Reagan, Americans understood that the government is the instrument of the American people. It is the representative of the people. That's what representation means. And in a democratic republic, that's what we've always had. But we've forgotten that ever since Reagan, and it's only gotten worse. In the age of Trump, the government is seen as the evil master behind the scenes, pulling all the puppet strings so that problems exist, and so that everything that is not the government is somehow the real source and legitimacy, as if the government is somehow opposed to the people and the opposite of the people. Well, that might be true in an authoritarian nation, but it's not true in a democratic republic such as the United States. I recorded a fireside chat by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 when he was explaining in the very first of his famous fireside chats why the government was doing its best to solve the banking crisis, which went over well with the American people, and a crisis in which all the banks were closed in the nation became, within 1 week of FDR's rising to the presidency, a problem that was substantially solved and solved by the reassurance that FDR brought to the nation with that fireside chat. And in that fireside chat, FDR said, "You may wonder why some banks are not going to be opened for a couple of days." And he said, "That's because your government has determined that the history of the last few weeks shall not be repeated, and that the bank crisis, the run on the banks, the bank closures shall be reformed by a representative government that knows the mind of the American people and that knows how to function." With the Warren Report, we have an excellent example of that in action. The Warren Report compiled more information on the JFK assassination than on any other crime in history. And it is a tragic farce that most of the books on the JFK assassination pretend that the Warren Commission did a terrible job, even while it takes all of the evidence compiled by the Warren Commission and twists it into the opposite of what it really represents. A coherent and skillful explanation of the assassination as it could have been known in 1963 and 1964. The problems that the Warren Commission encountered were not problems of its own making. They were deficits caused by the failure of a few government agencies, particularly the FBI and the CIA, to reveal what it knew about its own misdeeds in the assassination, about its real incompetence in trailing Lee Harvey Oswald. Those agencies weren't plotting against the American people either, but they were typical bureaucratic agencies trying to cover their tracks and so protect their own bureaucratic interests. That's a far cry from a plot to take the liberties away from the American people. If the American people do not trust their government, then they are taking their own liberties away from them, because the government is simply the people writ large, the representative of the people in a democratic republic. If we want to continue to condemn government as a force for good, then we're staring at a future of authoritarianism. Is that what we want in 2024? We need to wake up and realize that things like the Warren Report show the government at its best, show the American people at its best, because in the end, the government of the United States is the voice of the American people, and we need to get back to that reality and stop going down the rat hole of disbelief in facts, disbelief in truth, and belief in carnival barkers like Donald Trump and, sad to say, Ronald Reagan as well. Next time, we'll look at Chapter 4 and see if the Warren Commission's skillful investigation of the JFK assassination continues the high level we've seen thus far. Until then, this is your host for Audibly Speaking, Rick Ryman, wishing you happy listening.